My name is Ketan. I'm the Vice President of Engineering for Indeed's Job Seeker products. Like everyone who works at Indeed, I help people get jobs. That's our purpose as a company. That's what we do. The way that we help people get jobs is through our search. Our original tagline was one search, all jobs. You give us keywords, you give us a location, and we show up jobs that match. On the back end, there are a bunch of different websites, and we crawl them. We gather all of the job information from these sites. We store them into our databases and data stores. We provide this to job seekers through our search interface, and then they get the jobs and they're happy. At least that's how it works in theory. Sometimes, as any SRE knows, things break and the user experience looks a little bit more like this. Like, this is a terrible experience, right? They're seeing an error page. It's not even a mobile-friendly error page. This is just an appalling, awful user experience. And this is why we need service-level objectives. We monitor our sites, we track how well we're doing, and we use that to guide our decisions for how to architect and build and improve the systems. So for instance, we might have an SLO violation that notifies us that job search was broken for 13 minutes for users in Vietnam. And we can say, this took our availability down to 98.98%, but our target was 99.99%. This all sounds good, this is a great thing to have in place, but my son might ask, Daddy, where do SLOs come from? And I have an easy answer for that. The SREs define the SLOs. That sounds right. Even my six-year-old thinks, maybe there's a problem. I don't think Daddy knows the answer, because this doesn't sound right, does it? Why shouldn't SREs define SLOs? It's something that we talk about constantly. It's something that I've heard many times in just this first day of the conference. Well, your product exists to serve users. And that's what it's there for. And in order to be a good SRE, you track service level indicators, which are a quantifiable measure of the quality of a service. And then you take these indicators and you turn them into targets or service level objectives, which are targets for the level of service that you want to provide as measured by that indicator. As a result, SLOs determine user experience. But we have SREs who are determining SLOs. So does that mean that SREs determine user experience? This is starting to look like it might be a problem. Your SREs aren't your users. Your SREs don't talk to your users. They're not on the phone with them. They're not emailing them back and forth. And your SREs don't understand your users. Your users may be talking wolf and your SREs are talking tiger. This is a real problem, right? Because you're determining the user experience, but there's this large disconnect between your users and your SREs. Now, SLOs are great tools. SLOs are consistent, they're objective, they're measurable, and they're explicit. But one thing they're not is empathetic. You don't naturally have empathy in your SLOs. And so that could be a bit of a problem. You put together an SLO and you put an SLO violation. You think, is this an empathy? Does this have feeling? Does it have emotion? Not so great. So you want to put empathy in your SLOs because SLOs without empathy are bad SLOs. SLOs are all about numbers, but the problem is that these are feelings and feelings are not numbers. You've got to find some way to turn these feelings into numbers, or as I put it, to quantify your empathy. Let's take a simple example of the SLO violation I showed before. If we're adding quantified empathy to SLOs, instead of just saying SLO violation and job search was unavailable for 13 minutes, we can actually say 3,802 job seekers can't get jobs because my t-shirt, everybody's t-shirt at Indeed says, I help people get jobs. And then maybe we could put some of the faces of the people who can't get jobs. Maybe we can put their sad faces because we're harming them. We're not serving them as we hope. That's maybe a little dose of empathy in an SLO. What I'm going to cover is how you quantify empathy. Quantifying empathy will lead you to create better SLOs. These better SLOs will help you make smarter decisions. When you make smarter decisions, you're going to build a better product. And that is going to make your users happier. Now, SLOs are a great tool. They make people better. People sleep, unfortunately. I slept 12 hours yesterday after flying here from Austin, Texas. But SLOs are open 24/7. They run around the clock. And of course, people do crazy things like go on holiday. But SLOs are always working. Empathy is an individual thing that humans have, which is really nice, but it's not very scalable. SLOs are collective. They represent a shared understanding of what we want from our product. And then, you know, people, they need food, they have moods, they have all of these biological needs and these fluctuations. But SLOs don't get hangry, ever. You can count on your SLO to be steady and reliable. So we want to keep all of these good aspects of SLOs. But lack of empathy will lead to a subpar experience. For example, your users could be more demanding than your SLO. You could have a good user experience that's all the way up here, but the SLO that you've set is down here. And that space in between, that's the empathy gap between what your SREs are targeting and what your user experience needs. You also may overlook features in your SLOs. Your SLOs may not cover things that matter to your users. And so you've got this larger space of features your users care about, but there's a smaller set that's being covered by your SLOs. And that uncovered space is going to be a gap in your user experience and pain for your users. There's the flip side also. Lack of empathy leads to wasted effort. In SRE, we think of ourselves as these modern, awesome, amazing guys who are always harder, better, faster, stronger, right? That's what we do. We always push it further and further and better and better. But is a higher service level always better? There's this escalating cost. As you get closer and closer to perfection, your cost goes higher and higher. And you're never actually going to achieve that perfection. It's an asymptote. So maybe this is too much of a good thing, trying to get this perfect level of service. These higher service levels, they cost time. Higher service levels cost money. Most importantly, higher service levels cost opportunity. Whatever time you spend bringing your product up to a higher service level is time that you don't spend on other things. So you could have the situation where your users are less demanding than your SLO. You've got a good user experience that's about here, and that's what you want to target, but your SLO may be all the way up here. And so that space becomes waste, where your SREs are putting their time and their energy into things that don't necessarily actually lead to a good user experience. Your SLOs may also cover things your users don't care about. It could be a small set of things that your users care about, but there's this larger space that your SLOs cover. You might end up in this sad situation with some poor benighted SRE crushed under this giant rock of pointless alerts. These alerts that are waking you up, that are disturbing your lunch, disturbing your sleep, disturbing your life, and it doesn't actually make any difference to your users. That naturally prompts the question is, how good is just right? This is a user research and product management set of problems, but it is solved by technology teams. And in particular, it's solved by your SREs. Not only are SREs solving these problems, but SRE makes product decisions every time you go to work every single day. You're making a decision about whether to code for accuracy or for freshness, or speed versus availability. You might want to decide, are you going to add a new network point of presence, or are you going to implement auto-scaling? Try to do it better than these guys, though. You may have heard of the five whys. Now, there's a lot of debate about whether one should use the five whys in incident response and analysis, but in understanding the first principles of user experience and what you should prioritize as an SRE, the five whys can be a really useful tool. Let's take the example from before, adding a new point of presence versus implementing auto-scaling. We ask why. Why do we want to add a new point of presence? Well, we want to do that because we want fewer network hops between our user and our services. Why do we want to implement auto-scaling? Well, it adds capacity when needed. So one why deep, instead of add new point of presence versus implement auto-scaling, we've gotten to fewer network hops versus adds capacity when needed. We go into the second why, and that explains fewer network hops because we want faster page load. That's against more throughput in the other task we could do. Ask why a third time, and we get a lower bounce rate from faster page load versus fresher data from more throughput. Go into the fourth why. Lower bounce rate leads to increased engagement. Users are using our product more, this product that we built and we put a lot of time and effort into, versus greater utility of the product when the data is fresher. And then finally, our fifth why. Why do we want increased engagement? It's because it leads to higher revenue. If more people are using our product, then they're doing more of the revenue-driving tasks that pay your company's bills, that are going to pay my kids' college education. On the other hand, greater utility leads to higher retention. Higher retention means customers use our product longer, they use it more, they use it for more purposes. Now, people will disagree about which of these to prioritize. In marketing, they might say, we want faster pages because we know Google pays attention to that now. The CEO may say less downtime, thinking about the contracts and the SLAs. Software engineer may think, increase throughput because I want to see if I can really crank with my software. And then SRE is, of course, going to say, reduce errors. We want to have fewer usable visible errors, and we want to have fewer SRE visible errors. Not only will people disagree about what class of thing to focus on, people will disagree a lot about what to do with each class. So even if you agree on page load time, you might have marketing saying 400 milliseconds, that's what we should shoot for. And the CEO thinks 300 milliseconds, that's the better target. Software engineers are thinking, I can get this down to 250 milliseconds, I just need to spend the next 4 months on it. And then SRE is like, whoa, that's crazy. We can stop at 265. Because those 15 milliseconds, they make a huge difference. You've got to ask, how do you make sure your team gets it right? There's so many different ways that you can optimize your service, and there's so many different levels you can choose. Well, there's a simple answer to this. You have one person who makes all the decisions. This is a simple answer, and like any complex question with a simple answer, it's also the wrong answer. In software engineering, we call this the God object anti-pattern, where you've got one component in your software that knows everything and it reaches its tentacles into everything, controls everything. It becomes a maintainability nightmare, it becomes opaque and impossible to understand, and it also scales very poorly. This is the same problem you'll have if you try to have one person making all the decisions about service levels. But no question, it's hard for SRE to make product decisions. You have to figure out how to anyway. One benefit is expanding your hiring pool. Your employee personalities are going to vary. In one bucket, you have the people who naturally understand users. They just have some kind of innate intuition, some kind of connection, and they understand what makes for a good user experience. Then there's a larger bucket of people who can understand users with training, with coaching, with guidance. And then there's a group of people who don't understand users, and no matter how much training you give them, they'll never develop that intuition and that empathy. Now, the thing is, all of these can be valuable employees. All of them can help your company serve its goals and achieve its purpose. Can you limit your candidate pool to just these people who automatically, intuitively understand your users? You need to look more broadly as you grow and as you scale. Individuals themselves don't scale. Over time, assuming you're achieving good success, your product complexity will steadily increase. Also, the number of products you have will steadily increase. But the thing is, as much as you try to hire the best people, even the best people have limits. They can only eat so many hot dogs, right? Even if they're the best hot dog eater in the world. You can't scale up just by making things bigger. You start with a lizard, right? And you make it really, really big. And you get our pal Godzilla here. Godzilla is fiction, Godzilla is fantasy, because if you scale up a lizard, it wouldn't be able to support its system. Its heart would collapse under its own weight. It couldn't hold itself up. If you actually want to scale things up, you can't just make them bigger. You have to re-architect them with stronger, more durable materials that give you a mecha Godzilla that can then threaten all of humanity, if that's your goal. So how do you overcome all these obstacles? That's the key to quantify empathy. Step one, you get to know your users. Step two, you understand what your product does for them. Step three, apply the six flavors of user happiness that I'm going to tell you about. Step four, find the user pain in your data. And five, set your SLOs to be below the pain threshold. This is everyone's job. Marketing, software engineering, the CEO, SRE. SLOs are a particular technical tool focused on by SREs, but it's everyone's job because all of this adds up to a comprehensive, high-quality user experience. Now, I've talked a little bit about Indeed. This applies to all products. It applies to Indeed, where we have one search, all jobs. As mentioned before, we gather jobs from all these different sites across the internet and make them available to job seekers. In understanding our users, we understand that job seekers care about fast page loads. They care about getting all jobs, and they care about getting the jobs quickly enough. They also care about seeing more jobs, even at the risk of irrelevance, because they'd rather cast a wider net and do their own filtering than have Indeed potentially exclude jobs that might be relevant to them. On the other hand, job seekers care less about perfect accuracy. If we get close enough, that's good enough for them, and they can apply their own reasoning and their own knowledge to narrow the scope. They also care less about all the features. Our core job experience should help people get jobs. We can enhance this experience in various ways, but those are nice-to-haves. They also care less about avoiding all irrelevant jobs. They have some tolerance for some amount of noise. Now, I said empathy applies to all products, so let's take something completely different, capturing the flag. I spent way, way too much of my life on this game, and I'm dating myself a little bit here, but I spent a ton of my life in Quake 3 Arena, primarily playing Capture the Flag. If you're not familiar with Capture the Flag, you've got two teams, each of whom has a flag. Your goal is to steal the opponent's flag while protecting your own and preventing them from taking your flag. When you play games like this, flag capturers, they care about lag, or really the absence of lag. It's a reflexive game. It's a fast twitch game, and so any amount of lag becomes problematic. They care less about availability, because this is not a mission-critical thing. If I don't get to play the game, it's a little bit annoying, it's a little bit frustrating, but it's not like anything terrible happens. Let's take a third case study, again to illustrate that empathy applies to a lot of different products. I fly a lot, I travel a lot. I fly on American Airlines, and sometimes there are problems. Luckily, not quite as bad as this problem, but the same effect. So I travel, I was traveling to London 2 weeks ago. We pushed back from the terminal, and then as the pilot was spooling up the engines to get us going, something went wrong, and we had to go back to the terminal. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad we went back to the terminal instead of attempting to fly, but nonetheless, this was frustrating. Like, fudge my life. Let's say fudge. So I get off the plane, and I hop on the phone, and my mind is buzzing, my mind is spinning. I call up the airline customer service as quickly as I can. And I'm just, okay, like, my flight canceled, I need to get on a different one, blah, 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 blah. And they don't necessarily have the greatest IT systems, so I'm in this state of nervous anxiety, and I'm blabbing all this stuff, and the customer service rep on the other side is like, who is this guy? Like, what's, back up. Tell me some basic facts. Let me look it up. Please hold while I find your reservation. And I'm in the state of nervous anxiety, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, while this glacial mainframe system from the 1960s pulls up my reservation so I can actually get on the next flight that takes me to London, which I really only have an hour to do. So I was already frustrated, right? I'm an advisor for a company that tries to solve this problem called Tenfold. The way they operate is they have a customer. Their customer calls their customer support line. That plugs into the Tenfold product. It pulls in data about that customer from a bunch of different databases, consolidates it all into a single view, and it presents it to the customer service agent before the agent picks up the phone. So as soon as I've connected with an agent, they can see what my problem is, and they say, oh, Mr. Gangadharkar, I see your flight has had difficulty. Can I help arrange a new flight for you? That is a great thing for me to hear as a customer in this really difficult, frustrating time. Customer service representatives are going to care about fast enough page loads. They want reasonable timeliness, but it doesn't have to be the absolute fastest thing. They also care about availability because they've got frustrated, anxious people calling them up. So they need that service to be available. They care about data freshness. It does no good if they pull up data from an hour before my flight was canceled. That doesn't help me. I might as well be starting from zero. And they also care about accuracy. It should accurately represent what my situation is and not try to approximate in any level. Customer service representatives care less about the fastest possible page loads. It just needs to be good enough. It doesn't have to be the fastest possible thing, like in a game like Quake 3. They also care less about lots of features. They would just want to have the core data set. It doesn't have to be fancy and decorated with all kinds of bells and whistles. Now, when I get into empathy and how we find it in the data, I submit to you that empathy is an S-curve. And you can map any product to an S-curve of empathy. In a generic sense, you've got user happiness on one scale, and you've got some degree of brokenness on the other scale. At the high end of user happiness, you've got basically a perfect user experience. And you can actually tolerate some degree of brokenness in your system before it becomes really problematic for the user. And then at the far end, you have uselessly broken. Your system is so broken that there's nothing you can do short of drastic measures to make your user happy. The interesting part is here in the middle, where your software is some degree of broken, but it's sufficiently usable that the user can get their job done. The sweet spot, of course, that you want to target is here, above tolerable, and it gives you some amount of padding so that if there's a blip in the night, you don't fall into the horribly broken state. This applies to the six flavors of user happiness. These six flavors are availability, responsiveness, freshness, completeness, accuracy and precision, and breadth of functionality. And if you have any trouble remembering this, there's this really great mnemonic or acronym you can use, ARFCABBOF. Or if you're posting on social media, hashtag ARCABBOF. So availability is easy. It's can your product perform its most basic functions? In Indeed's case, that's finding jobs for job seekers. For Quake 3 Arena, it might be capturing the flag. And then for Tenfold, it's displaying customer records. Let's look at Quake. We resolve user happiness down to flagaliciousness. And the measure that we're looking at here is availability. At the high end of availability, let's say 2.5 nines, I'm getting the flag. It's awesome. You know, I have some frustration to burn off after that frustrating experience on customer service. So I'm bouncing around, I'm fragging the enemy, I'm stealing their flag. Really good. Availability drops below 2.5 nines. Okay, you know, maybe I'll try again later. This isn't such a great experience not having the server available. If it drops below 98%, well, you know, this is just a game. It doesn't matter a whole lot. So the S-curve for Quake 3 Arena might look a little bit like this. And I might, as a server operator, set my service level objective to be 2.5 nines of availability. I don't need to aim for a really high standard. It's, you know, decent, good enough. On the other hand, there's something like Tenfold, which is enterprise software that gets big dollar checks. When I'm looking at customer service productivity against availability, 3 nines, the customer service rep, they can do their job. Below 3 nines, there's a steep drop off, but it's still kind of in the tolerable range. Below 2.5 nines, customer service reps start asking, we're paying how much for this system that's barely functioning? And then below 2 nines of availability, you've got the CEO of this company saying, cancel the contract. This is unacceptable. We're writing checks with lots of zeros in them, and you're only giving us 98.9% availability? That's just unacceptable. So this, while still following an S-curve, is a very different shape of S-curve with different inflection points. Here, we might set the target at 3.5 nines of availability, because for big dollar enterprise software, you need to be better than tolerable, and you certainly don't want to risk your contract. Then there's responsiveness. Responsiveness I define here as the user takes an action, and then there's a product reaction. It's the time from when the user does something to when you see something in your software. Let's take Indeed's case, and let's look at the user action as the job click based on the page load time. This is a shallow S-curve with a steady decline, no clear elbow. At the high end, we're maxing out our job clicks in the 125 to 250 millisecond range. And then it steadily drops off until we get to 8 16-second page loads. At the high end, if we double our latency, we see relatively little click loss because there's not much user perceptible difference between 125 milliseconds and 250 milliseconds. We also see something similar at the low end. If we go from 8,000 milliseconds to 16,000 milliseconds, the experience is so catastrophically broken that we've lost everything well before we got to 8,000 milliseconds. So there's very little user experience to lose if we double that and make it considerably worse. On the other hand, there's a very interesting point right here where between 250 and 500 milliseconds, if we double latency, there's a significant click loss. There's a significant detectable loss in user experience and user success. So we might set our service level objective to be under 250 milliseconds before we have that steepening part of the curve where we severely compromise, where we start to severely compromise user experience and user success. In our different use case of Quake 3 Arena, maybe we look at flags captured against network latency. At the high end, under 50 milliseconds, it's great. I'm awesome. I'm fragging all the enemy. I'm defending my flag super well, and I'm taking their flag at will. I'm blasting every single person out of the way. Latency gets a little bit higher, 50 to 80 milliseconds, and this is okay. I can play. I may be more of the middle of the pack. I'm not feeling godlike anymore, but you know, it's still good fun. Once it drops below 80 milliseconds, I'm switching to solitaire. Quake 3 Arena is just too frustrating. It's not an enjoyable experience anymore. This also follows an S-curve, but it's a very different shape of S-curve from Indeed. If I were a server operator, I might set my goal to be under 80 milliseconds for latency. I do want to make people happy, but as long as people are getting sufficient enjoyment to keep playing, that's good enough for me. The third flavor is freshness. Freshness is how close to real-time the data are. A lot of services rely on presenting data to your users. And so understanding this means trying to understand how our user goals are compromised by stale data. Let's take a look at Indeed again. And we plot user happiness against Indeed's job availability, or how laggy the job availability is. If we're showing jobs within 6 hours, this is awesome, because job seekers are not coming to Indeed every 15 minutes. Job seekers are coming once, maybe twice a day, often several times a week. So they're not gonna notice anything that happens faster than 6 hours. Between 6 hours and 24 hours, it's still pretty good. And I mean, this website is free, right? We don't charge job seekers for this. Once it gets beyond 24 hours, they start to think heretical thoughts, like I should use Glassdoor instead. Because we're not actually serving the job seeker so well anymore. Job seekers care to some degree about timeliness, but if we're not showing the jobs within 24 hours, they start to get antsy, they start to get impatient. They want to use other sites or go directly to the sites that we aggregate. So we might set our service level objective right here, kind of in the middle. We want 99% of jobs within 18 hours or so. That's enough to keep users reasonably happy, but not necessarily driving us to extremes. If we look at Tenfold in terms of user data, we have to think about another use case. Sometimes when talking with a customer service representative, you're doing things yourself. You're working on a flight reservation or you're interacting with some kind of financial system. So you're on the phone and you're talking to them and you're doing stuff on your computer. That stuff needs to feed into the Tenfold system, and then from the Tenfold system needs to become visible to the customer service representative. And since you're speaking to this person in real time, you want your actions to be pretty close to real time as well, because otherwise the customer service rep can't follow along with what you're doing and give you the most help. If we plot product value against the account data lag, at the high end, if it's less than 10 seconds for your actions to show up to the customer service rep, this is awesome. This is a great experience. You do something, brief pause, and then the customer service rep can see it and you move on to the next step. If it takes more than 10 seconds, this works okay. this is decent, this is tolerable, but your customer service rep has to do a little bit of tap dancing. They have to say, okay, thank you, Mr. Gangadharkar, just hold on. Okay, I see your update now. If it's worse than 20 seconds, well, it's painful, it's difficult, right? It takes a long time, but it's maybe better than nothing, right? At least they can sort of see what they're doing. Once you get past 30 seconds though, okay, I was wrong. I would actually rather have nothing. I would rather, as a customer, relate what I'm doing as I'm doing. So they might set their service level objective to be under 15 seconds. It's bordering on the awkward range, but it's decent. Fourth flavor is completeness. Completeness is basically, do you have all of the data? And you want all of the data, right? This is the era of big data. This isn't actually all of the data. This is just five data. There are a lot more. At Indeed, we pride ourselves, as I said, our original tagline was one search, all jobs. So if we look at the number of missing jobs on Indeed and we think about user perception, at the high end, when we're missing fewer than 25% of jobs, job seekers think, okay, one search, all jobs, totally credible. If we're missing some jobs, between 25 and 50% of the jobs on the internet, it's maybe like one search, most jobs. If we get worse than that, if we're missing more than 50% of the jobs, it's one search, some jobs. That's not really a compelling value proposition, right? That's not an enticing user experience. And then if it's more than that, more than 75% of jobs missing, it's one search, no jobs. We're a bunch of rank amateurs. We can't even get a good logo up there. Is that Comic Sans? That's embarrassing. So we might set our service level objective to be less than 25% missing jobs. Then there's accuracy and precision. I simplified the Indeed view a little bit earlier. We've got all of these sites that we aggregate. We pull them into a jobs database, but this is actually a raw jobs database. We do some additional processing where we try to find the exact job location using another service. Then we take that, put that into a process job database, which then serves our job seekers. Now, sometimes this service is broken. And because it's sometimes broken, we actually have a pass-through from raw jobs to process jobs where we can skip this step. Take Singapore, for example. Singapore is not a large place, but it's big enough that people care. We can have an approximate location somewhere in Singapore that tells the job seekers where the job is. That's less than ideal. If we can get a more precise location, it's better for the job seekers. We can narrow it down to the central business district. Now, this is a classic trade-off because we have this possibly broken, possibly slow external service that we're reliant on. And so if it's broken, we have to decide, do we want an approximate location faster, or do we want a more precise location, but have that be slower? If we understand our user, we see this as a trade-off between whether job seekers want faster delivery of jobs to the site, or do they want more precise locations of the jobs. As I described before, job seekers are willing to tolerate some degree of irrelevance. And so we can set an SLO that says we want the most exact location possible as long as it's less than 30 minutes lag to the site. And if it's going to take more than 30 minutes, we just skip the exact location and give the approximate location. The sixth flavor is breadth of functionality. Every product has a balance of must-have features versus nice-to-have features. And balancing this for your service level objectives means asking, how often are the nice-to-have features available, or how often should the nice-to-have features be available? Let's take Indeed's search site. We have these handy links here and this handy information here. These are ratings and reviews of employers, just like many sites. This tells how good of an employer a company is based on employee reviews, and they can actually get qualitatively into the reviews by seeing what people say about it. Now, this is not our core mission. Our core mission is to help people get jobs. And so we could have a broken ratings and review service, but still serve our job seekers with a search page that lacks these features. It's still usable. It still serves the purpose of helping job seekers get jobs. So if we realize that this is a nice to have, a valuable feature, but not a necessary feature, we can design an SLO around that. Perhaps we'll set a target that 95%+ of pages have stars, the ratings and the reviews, but we also implement a hard timeout at 100 milliseconds because we don't want to compromise the performance and availability of the core search experience. If we can get those data, great. If we can't, we'll just move on. This is why it's important to have empathy for the user. You want to turn the implicit intuition that you have about user experience and make it into explicit systems that can guide your organization. It can guide the people who don't have this intuition and don't have this empathy. And you can scale it up as your organization grows. There are many different ways to draw an S-curve when you're plotting user happiness against brokenness. One S-curve might look like this. You've got a plateau, a relatively steep drop-off, and then a long, shallow tail. Or you might have a more gentle slope, where the brokenness hurts your users more slowly over time. You could have something where users actually tolerate a relatively low level of performance for a large amount of brokenness before steeply falling off. Or you could have very demanding users, where there's only a small zone of tolerance where they're happy, and then a steep drop-off when there's any amount of brokenness. This might be a financial system, for example. To find your S-curve, you need to look inside your data. Find the relationship between user happiness and brokenness in your system. And then try to find the S-curve within all of these individual points. One thing you need to understand from this point of view is that perception is reality. Your perceptions are only part of the picture. You may have great service times, 100% awesome. You may have great server error rates, again, 100% awesome. But your user experience could be awful. It could be a real tearjerker. How does this happen? Well, we've got this complex system that we've built to serve our users. All of these different layers that a user action passes through before we pass back the reaction from our product. This stuff over here on the right, that's easy to measure. That's all well within our control. The stuff over here, that's kind of hard to measure, right? But this stuff on the right, we're all techies, we're all geeks, but this is basically technobabble. All of these acronyms, all of these obscure terms, all of these things that we geek out on, but it's not the user experience. The user experience is over here in what's hard to measure. So if you want to really measure the user experience, you have to simulate your clients. That means building more than just availability probes. You actually have to simulate clients and interact with your product. You also want to measure from real clients using real user metrics, various APIs that plug in and instrument your real clients to understand the experience that they're feeling, not just what your monitors tell you. When you do this, you're going to be dealing with factors beyond your control. You've got this user experience, and it's the totality of things that are out of your control and then things that are in your control. And that can be really frustrating, this division. But your SLO should control the whole user experience. Whether you control it or not, it's part of what your users see. And so your service level objectives should cover both of them as well. There's the component that you can't control, and then what's left is what you have to work with. That may not be all of your experience, but it tells you what's allowed. So let's take the experience of a page load, and you want that to be within 1 second. Maybe your user's network adds 400 milliseconds to anything that they do. Well, that leaves you with 600 milliseconds to work with. You may not be able to control those 400 milliseconds, but at least you can understand it and allow for it, and know that you have to operate within 600 milliseconds. And then, of course, sometimes you can control for what you can't control. We may have a user that has too much latency between them and our service. And you want to do something about that, but you can't move your users closer to your servers. I've tried. I've sent very politely worded letters and say, just come a little closer to our data center. You'll get better response times. I don't even get a reply. But you can move your servers closer to your users and get that latency down to something acceptable. There are also other cases. If you're presenting web pages, your user loads up the web page. They spend some amount of time reading it. And then once they've read it, they click to go to the next page. And then they wait. And then they wait. And then they wait. And then the page appears. This waiting is a function of their network. You can make your pages super fast, but if the network is slow, there's nothing you can do about this, right? Well, maybe there is. They read your page, right? They digest it. And while they're doing that, you trigger a page load for the next one. You request the next page and you store it locally. Then when the user clicks on the link to go to the next page, boom, the next page is there instantly. You haven't made their network any faster, but you've made it feel fast. And when you're having empathy and looking at things from the user perspective, you realize that if it feels fast, it is fast. Empathy also avoids overkill. Your user experience is a combination of your external systems plus your components. You've got your user, you've got their phone, you've got their cell network. These are things outside your control. And then you've got your load balancer, you've got your application, you've got your services and your data store. These things are in your control, and you could be the best SRE in the world. You've got 16 nines of availability, which is 315 nanoseconds per year. You could be super duper awesome. But if your user's infrastructure is only 2 nines, they're not going to see all of the awesomeness in your stack. You end up with a situation like this. In theory, your S-curve looks like this, user success versus brokenness. But if your user system is fairly broken, then all this stuff is overkill. Your users will never see any efforts that you put in beyond what's visible to them. All right, so wrapping up with quantifying empathy with the 17 seconds that I have left. Empathy in the real world means I feel what you feel. And that starts with understanding that your user's perception is their reality. And if you're building a system to serve your users, you have to understand that your user's perception must be your reality as well. You've got all of these user needs, right? You translate these user needs into service level objectives that are objective, consistent, measurable, and so forth. And then this can become actionable guidance for your SREs. Even if they lack intuition and they lack empathy, this becomes a tool for them to simulate empathy and simulate intuition to satisfy these user needs. When you model these user feelings, you're creating a system that can simulate empathy. What you want to have happen here is that when you have a sad user, you have a failing SLO. That's actually a good SLO. That SLO has empathy. If you have a sad SLO and you're meeting your, if you have a sad user and you're meeting your SLO, that's an empathy gap. You're missing some user pain here. On the other hand, if you have a happy user and a failing SLO, that could be a sign that you have overkill. And then finally, if you're meeting SLO and you have a happy user, that's of course the best possible outcome. But you actually need to fill all four of these buckets to have an accurate simulation. SLOs with empathy will tell me what you, my user, feel. Even better, SLOs with empathy will tell me what you will feel before you feel it. It's before the user notices there's a problem. My empathy simulator will say, users are going to be unhappy because this thing is happening. It's before the user feels pain. Maybe there's a brief blip and your systems address it. It could even be before you deploy your service. When you're talking about the right service level objectives and how that maps to your users, you can model in advance and you can target in advance what you need to build to. How to quantify empathy? You get to know your users. You understand what your product does for them. You apply the 6 flavors of user happiness. You find the user pain in your data. And then you set your SLOs below the pain threshold. This is good all around. How you benefit from quantifying empathy is that you raise targets that allow that currently allow for a poor user experience. But you can lower targets that don't benefit the user, so you don't get crushed under useless alerts. You can find gaps in features that are not covered by SLOs that are causing your users pain. And then you can discard SLOs for features your users don't need, that they're okay doing without. And then finally, you can get everyone in your organization lined up behind the same goals. No longer are you reliant on subjective intuition that's hard to communicate. You've got a suite of SLOs that communicate this empathy. If you quantify your empathy, you're going to create better SLOs, you're going to make smarter decisions, you're going to build a better product, and you're going to make your users happier. Thank you.